Bibi Hansen, pop culture icon, performance artist, musician, and actress known for her work with Andy Warhol, was part of the University at Albany's The Creative Life Conversation Series with me in the fall of last year. Born to the Bohemian poet Audrey Austin Hansen and Fluxus artist Al Hansen in 1952, she was introduced to Andy Warhol in 1964 when her father took her to the popular Bohemian artist hangout, Stark's Coffee Shop, in New York City. She became the youngest of the Warhol superstars at just 12 years old, starring in his films Prison and Restaurant. She also sat for two screen tests for Warhol the following year. The Creative Life Series is a major arts initiative of the New York State Writers Institute, UAlbany Performing Arts Center, and University Art Museum, in conjunction with WAMC, produced with major support from the University at Albany Foundation. This conversation was recorded on September 5th, 2018, at the University Art Museum on UAlbany's Uptown campus.
Well, what a delight. It's very nice. Thank you very much for inviting us, and thank you for coming and for talking about your creative life with us. It's a great pleasure to have you here. Well, we'll get to the meeting of Warhol. But 14, you'd already been in jail. Mm. So let's start with that.
Okay.
You had done a pop record, right?
Yeah, I actually had done that the year before.
All right, and then what happened?
So much. Well, you know, the one good thing is I get a lot of material to work with in my writing and stuff, but it was quite an adventure. My father is an artist, not a very well-heeled one, a kind of experimental, down-and-out, the classic impoverished artist. And my mother had custody of me, and my mother was a heroin addict. Together, she and I had many rollicking adventures in the super understructure of New York City and environs, going from one scrape to another. And in the course of that, I came to the attention of the authorities of the city and state of New York, because I wasn't in any school. I wasn't showing up in any of the three or four schools I was enrolled in different parts of the city, and hadn't been. Neither was I at any of the addresses that I had been listed at for attending any of those schools. And when they tracked down my father, he hadn't seen me in a really long time. Oh, and then my name started popping up in a lot of other contexts that they didn't like at all. Like, wanted as a material witness for questioning in regards to a homicide on the Upper West Side. And then wanting to talk to me about a certain counterfeiting ring on the Lower East Side that was doing that. And I kept popping up. My name kept popping up in all these contexts where a 13-year-old isn't supposed to be. So they said, well, my, I think we need a pins on this person, and that's a person in need of supervision. And no doubt I could have used a little.
So you didn't really necessarily do anything wrong other than just try to survive the circumstance you were in.
Pretty much. I mean,
assuming you didn't commit the homicide. No,
I didn't. I was just traveling through those places. But, you know, there's a generally agreed upon societal norms that children are supposed to be going to school and have a home and not be living on the streets and dealing drugs and guns and things like that, you know. So they need to be someplace where people have an eye on them, and I wasn't. The way I actually got into jail was I went home.
Yeah, enough of this.
At one point, my father put an ad for me in the Village Voice newspaper, and this is about 1964 or something, before the big runaways, and that was common, and it said, you know, something like, happy birthday, Bibi, come home, you know, stop screwing around and give me a call, get off the streets, you know, one of those ads. And eventually I did, and when I did, he called into the local precinct and said, well, I've got her, what, you know, my daughter just walked in, what do I do now? And he listened, and I said, okay. And he hung up, and he said, well, they'd like to see you over there at the precinct. He said, you see, when you didn't, you know, show up anywhere, they came to me and said they were going to take me in for child neglect and endangerment, and I'm not going to jail. So I guess you are. So off we went, and that's how that happened.
And you were there for how long?
Oh, 5-6 months, something like that. Mm. I kept going back and forth to court. It was on 23rd Street back in that day. Family court was on 23rd Street in Chelsea, right across the street from the Chelsea Hotel. So that was always interesting, getting off the prison bus with the, you know, the shackles, and you shove in the two lines of police, like, and you get sent into this basement sub-holding cells.
I'm sorry, you were in shackles?
Oh, yeah, this is a whole other subject, which is called juvenile incarceration.
Yeah.
The prison movements and all this kind of stuff. But it's horrific.
But that would seem like
this
truancy.
This is Spofford Street, which was one of the most heinous, scandalous, horriblest youth prisons that had been. And it's still, you know, legendary in terms of how rotten it really was. But yeah, and there would be kids for truancy, for trying to stab their parents, for, you know, prostitution, and just all together, you know, whatever it was.
So your story wasn't as good as theirs then, was it?
Well, we had a lot in, you know,
common.
Yeah.
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 Are there any lasting friendships from that time?
There's a lot of memories. And yes, there are some lasting. Actually, I am still in love, in touch, and very much involved with several old friends from those times, and we're still connected.
So when you get out, it's how long? My understanding, it's just a very short period of time between you getting out of jail and meeting Andy Warhol.
That's right. Less than 24 hours.
Yeah.
I got out on a Friday, and on Saturday there was this ritual in New York at the time in the art community, and that's that everybody would do the galleries uptown, and you'd go up to 57th Street, and you'd do the galleries on 57th Street, and you go down to Madison, and then you go uptown on Madison, and you go back and forth across the avenue till you got up to Castelli Gallery. And after that, you'd go up to Madison across the street to a bar restaurant called Stark's. There were a couple of them in New York back in that day. And at a back table were a bunch of my father's friends back there at a table, and they invited us over. It's Roy Lichtenstein, Andy Warhol, Chuck Wine, Gerard Malanga, Ivan Karp from Castelli, and they invited us to sit down, and Roy bought us a couple of burgers, and that was a real pleasure after eating Youth House food for all those months. It was a really good burger, so I lit into that, and they were just doing their art guy stuff. Right? They were like, blah, 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 and this opening and that opening and this person and that person. And I was just really having fun with my hamburger. And all of a sudden, I felt these eyes on me. And I looked up, and Andy Warhol is peering across the table at me. And he says, and you, what do you do? And before I could answer, my father burst in with, I just sprung her from jail.
Thanks, Dad.
And Andy said, oh, jail. Oh, please. Tell us about that. So I told him two or three war stories, and he was just enchanted. And he said, oh, I think he and Chuck said it at the same time, we have to make a movie about that. And Andy said, would you come to the factory and make a movie with me about jail? And I said, sure. And that's where it started.
We're speaking with Bibi Hansen as part of the Creative Life Conversation series. Bibi Hansen is a pop culture icon, performance artist, musician, and actress known for her work with Andy Warhol.
So a couple of follow-ups to that story.
Sure.
one being, what was his, just give us context, his level, Andy Warhol's level of fame at that point would have been what?
Well, it was during his time of the Silver Factory. Pop art was definitely springing and had sprung. He was being represented by Castelli Gallery, and Castelli had Chamberlain, Lichtenstein, and Andy, and they were doing shows and being very well considered. I think you would need a historian to be able to really pinpoint what precisely that point was, but he was pretty well known. He had just met Edie a couple of months before, and she had been in maybe one or two movies, and so he was in his first year and a half, 2 years, really, of making films, still using a still camera, not doing shots. And he was at that Silver Factory, what they call the Silver Factory. It was markedly different from what most people associate with Andy in terms of the place on Union Square, by Union Square and Max's, which was a completely different sensibility and a completely different art environment from what was happening at the Silver Factory.
So when it comes to your first time going to the factory, you didn't immediately go make the film. There was a screen test, correct?
Yeah, and the screen test wasn't a screen test. I mean, the stories, I mean, every time it's a different sort of story. What I was told when I posed for my screen test, not that it was a screen test, but that Andy had done a movie called 13 Beautiful Girls, and he was doing a sequel called 10 More Beautiful Girls. And they wanted to shoot a portrait of me as one of those. But subsequently, every time he showed 13 Beautiful Girls, he'd cut together different people. So I actually, it's considered, or it's in the books and the catalogs, as I'm in 13 Beautiful Girls, even though supposedly I was in a sequel for that. And later they became known as screen tests.
Was there, I have to ask this, because sure. It seems as though this would be the case, although we certainly, we shove a lot in our life deep down in ourselves that doesn't emanate until much later. But you're 14 years old, you've just come out of prison, and all of a sudden you're in this life. I mean, does it start to have an effect on you as to just reemerging into a quote-unquote normal society?
No, there was nothing normal about it.
Right, but as you said, it's different than jail.
Yeah, but, you know, so was where I was before. I mean, I've always had this really broad level of experience. You know, I'd be in, you know, Times Square at Jerry's, in Times Square, which was right out of Damon Runyon. It was like the last days of Damon Runyon there with, you know, fences and, you know, sex workers and thieves and addicts. And this is like, you know, 63, 64, you know. And this is like before Midnight Cowboy, you know, which was one world. And then I'd be in the Village, in Greenwich Village, hanging out with like Grace Paley's kids and going on anti-Vietnam War marches with the poet Grace Paley. And I'd be in Judson Church participating in one of my father's experimental theater pieces called Happenings, And then I'd be with the amphetamine addicts on the Lower East Side, you know, just like living on the streets and doing whatever. And I'd be at the Silver Factory with Andy and going out to nightclubs like Arthur and The Scene and, you know, operating on that sort of level, or hanging out in the park with Richie Havens and Jimi Hendrix. And, you know, it was that time. It was that time. It was kind of amazing. It was that social experiment that was the 60s was really wild. And people came together in all kinds of crazy ways that I don't think we've even quite seen since.
I just can't get over, though, that you're so young at this point. That doesn't have, so who is keeping track of you at this point?
Well, that was exactly what the state and city of New York wanted to know.
Right. So even after you get out of jail,
yeah,
your father then steps in, but that's a loose leash, I assume.
Yeah, it's a pretty that's pretty loose. I have to go see my probation officer regularly, and I have to show up at school. If I don't show up at school, I'm in deep. So there's a little bit of structure there, but outside of that, I'm pushing at it every chance I get, and still pretty out there. Yeah.
So you're out at clubs till, I assume, all hours of the night with Andy Warhol. I mean, that's there's nothing normal about that.
Nope, and Edie, and on my own. And one of the things I figured out, okay, so here's one way you work it. Here's an angle. One of the big places everybody loved to hang out were after-hours clubs and breakfast clubs after the clubs close. So instead of staying out all night, I'd wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. You still have an hour before the clubs close, and then you go to the Click or a Brasserie or whatever, and you're hanging out with all the people who were in all the clubs, and you just do that till 8 or 9 in the morning, and then you go to school. And I also figured out too, the whole thing about school is that if you're late, if you walk in at like a half an hour till noon, you're still just late.
Well, that's true. That's true.
You're not absent. You're not truant.
You're just late.
You have a lateness problem.
Yeah, if you're in a 10, you're late. You're in a 12, you're late.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So that was another little thing I figured out. You know, I'm very creative. Always been creative.
So you're at a club, mm-hmm. and you're talking to these people. And you're getting what out of it? In the sense of, what are you participating to the conversation? What are you getting out of the conversation? Now, obviously, you are not the average 14-year-old.
No. I mean, I'm reading Lawrence Durrell and, you know, Dostoevsky. You know, I mean, I'm just,
yeah.
You know, I'm like a, the Village Kids were really, we were really a strange group of kids. And before, when I was living in other places, I was very isolated with most other kids because I was weird. But when you're downtown, when you're on the Lower East Side, when you're in the Village, there were other weird kids just like you. And that was kind of nice. It was having the idea of having community. And so there were kids there, but there were also adults. And there was a certain lack of ageism, as there was a certain... at least in comparison to anything else that was going on in the world at that time, you know, racism, sexism, ageism. Andy didn't have those. You know, if you just look at prison, it's an all-female cast.
Mm. So how much structure? How much structure did being with and working with Andy Warhol give you at that time?
Oh, none at all. No, I mean, it, you know, in the, ex, it, just, See, what was happening at Andy's Factory at that time is really an extension of underground theater in New York City, what was happening downtown, Leroy Jones, the Happenings movement, the Beats, Diane DePrima. There was a class with John Cage at the New School in the late 50s, and a whole bunch of people went to that and came out of that completely radicalized in terms of art making and experimental theater, music, poetry, and ways of combining these that had never been thought of before. Dance, Judson dance group, just so many amazing talents. And in the Village, just the musicians, you'd walk on the street and just, you know, there's, you know, Dylan and Buffy St. Marie and all these Pete Seeger and it's just, that's a community. That's a community of people operating on all these different levels. But these experimental downtown artists, that's what Andy actually was a part of. He was a downtowner. I mean, he may have lived uptown and been a designer, but he was at all these events downtown. He was at Judson Church. He was at Jonas Mekas from the Film Archive, and at the time, the Cinematheque. He was an incredible, passionate proponent of cinema and experiments and experimental cinema at the time. And showing and screening these films to people like Andy. I mean, what inspires Andy? Where does Andy become Andy? You know, and there you go, Jonas Mekas, Anthology Film Archive, Cinematheque, and everything from the French New Wave to, you know, Maya Deren and beyond. And so all these things were sort of going on at the same time, and some of the people, so Andy started collaborating with some of these people. So there's people coming from all over, because there's also kind of Chuck Wine bringing in Edie Sedgwick from Boston, which is a completely different sort of set of backgrounds, which is completely different from Billy Name, Jack Smith, and myself, my father, you know, who were coming from the downtown art scene. Freddie Herko was a dancer, Judson Church with Fred Waring troupe. So what I'm getting here is that this is a community, and these people, this is very different than what happens in the 70s and 80s and even the late 60s. This was really a community of avant-garde experimental artists, theater people, dancers, musicians, painters, that were coming together to work on something with Andy. He had a camera. He had a film camera. That's something, that was a very expensive medium. That's not something that we would have the opportunity to work with. So this was a great pleasure to be able to work on that level with him with this kind of material, where he could get film developed. Because remember, this isn't video. This isn't digital. This is stuff that costs huge money, and we're mostly people who are barely scraping by. So this was incredible opportunity for us to work in this medium and to experiment in these ways. I mean, even if you think about Andy's openness, going to a 14-year-old and saying, I want to collaborate with you. Let's do a movie about what happened to you called Prison, you know? Like, come to the factory and we'll put it together. And gets Marie Menken and Edie Sedgwick and several other wonderful people together, and we make that movie. Then compare that with the idea and concepts you have about Andy Warhol, in terms of his later more exploitive Hollywood cinema that he did with Paul, or the Studio 54 and you know, the very glamorous Bianca Jagger days. This is a very different period that I'm in, and that I had this experience, and I feel very fortunate to have had it.
So I think there's a couple of ways to ask this question, but the basis of the question, or the what I'm trying to ultimately ascertain, okay, is how you graduated from that to the next phase of your life and ultimately what would become your career. But let me just back up and say, how did you survive that time?
Oh, well, that time was, you know, was the easy part. I mean, I could go up to the factory. I always got fed. I get like a pack of cigarettes, and I get taken out to lunch or taken out to dinner. I got to eat. It was a quiet respite from a crazy life that was happening downtown in New York City and in my home life on both sides of my parental equation. So there, in that sense, there was a kind of safe harbor and respite, mm-hmm, and that sort of quality of thing, which is, again, sort of belies the wild, crazy factory stories that we hear. That really wasn't something that was prevalent or going on at that period in time. In the daytime, it was a workplace. It was Andy's studio. It's where he got his work done. He would be interviewed there. Buyers, dealers might come. We made movies there. We planned things. After hours, the people who lived there were the caretakers, Billy and Ondine. Things might get kind of sketchy. Might get a little random late at night. But that was around the periphery, and that was certainly happening everywhere else in New York at the time. That was not something that was particular to the factory. So when we hear that the factory was this wild, crazy place, we kind of have to look at who's talking, because a lot of people who came through there were from kind of straight, middle-class, straight-up backgrounds. And they would look at it and say, wow, this is really wild. But it wasn't really that wild at all. It was pretty calm.
So for them, it was crazy. For you, it was,
yeah,
Tuesday.
Yeah, it was. Whew. And, you know, also remember, this is experimental film and experimental theater. But when I was 11, I was working in Summerstock Theater, Joan Frank's Saranac Lake Playhouse and Lake Placid Playhouse. And I was a fully professional working actor and theater person.
I was reading some of your reviews. You got nice notices.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So I was a child actor doing, I think my first role in Saranac Lake was, for Joan Frank, was The Miracle Worker.
Miracle Worker.
Yeah.
You were young, Helen Keller.
Yep. And, but earlier, I actually lived in Saranac Lake for a little while, and I worked in that summer theater for the previous owners, and a fellow was directing his first show, which was Cat in the Hot Tin Roof. And they brought me in on a one-day notice to play one of the no-neck monsters when I was 8. So that's technically my theatrical debut. Although I was in a church production of Puss in Boots and played Puss. And they're still getting over that one. But I have this, you know, I'm a working actor in, you know, living with the theater company on my own, doing apprentice duties, you know, painting flats, gelling lights, helping with costumes, selling tickets, making espresso at break time, doing, you know, some pretty major parts and filling in the chorus of musicals and playing some pretty serious, challenging roles at the same time. So that's a great learning experience. So there's a sophistication there, you know, just from working and making a living and operating on that level. And then there's the whole craziness with my mom.
Now,
which are providing me with my 800-page memoir in waiting, The Monster in the Box.
What is the expiration date, if you will, on the time that you spent at the factory? Like, what is the date of?
It's easy. I'm not in Chelsea Girls, it's just before Chelsea Girls, and the reason I disappear from the factory is that I go back to jail. I didn't make it. Yeah,
now,
they got me again, and
for the same thing.
Well, no, it's never quite the same thing, but yeah, on a number of different. And not being where I was supposed to be for long periods of time and name coming up in connection with things that you're not supposed to be connected with.
So
at that age.
You used the word a moment ago. You used two words. One was random, one was sketchy. did you identify it as that at the time? Meaning you look back at it now and you think of it as sketchy. But did you think of it as sketchy when it was happening? Did you think, oh, I probably shouldn't be here?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, when you're young, you're sort of doing what comes next. I don't really know how to answer that. I probably knew that things, you know, I was pretty smart and sharp, and I'd be in these situations that were quite dangerous or required a little bit of energetic manipulation to remove oneself to another point of safety or a better place. But you just sort of did what you had to, and you did what came next. Like we do.
When did jail end for you?
When I was about 16, 17, my mother died while I was in a institution in Westchester County, north of White Plains. And I didn't really see any purpose to being there any longer. And I went AWOL. I ran away. And through a series of things, I wound up getting a job in St. Thomas in the Caribbean, and I went down there and hid out till I was 18.
So, I'm sorry. So your mother passes away,
yeah.
And then you learn of that while you were in the institution,
yeah.
And then you go AWOL as a result of hearing that news.
No, not quite that way. I mean, I'm hanging out, but I had finished high school. And I wasn't getting released to a halfway house. They weren't really doing anything with me. I was just kind of hanging out. And I was about to get into some really big trouble over something. And I just said, nah, I'm done.
And your father is where in all of this?
In New York. I think he was living on 14th Street at the time.
So you go to St. Thomas,
yeah.
And then at what point do you start to think of a career? When do you start to think of, this is what I'm going to do with this life that I've been given, in these some awful things, but also some incredible opportunities, certainly, that we look back on now?
Oh, I'm always working. You know, I mean, even when I was in that last institution, you know, even in jail, I mean, I won the Hofstra Festival, Shakespeare Festival Best Actress Award from jail.
Well, congratulations.
You know,
that's great.
we toured with Othello, and I was Desdemona, and a wonderful actor, Paul, was Othello, and we grabbed both prizes. We scored. And so, you know, I was always working. You know, so even there, I mean, one of the great things about that particular institution is they had a very sophisticated arts program. So I just lucked into being able to go there. Maccabee Greenfield was their art teacher, and he was a teacher at Art Students League in New York City. So, I mean, just dumb luck sometimes, right? And being able to work with what you get. So I went to the Caribbean, and I just stayed there till I was 18 and came back to New York and then went to Los Angeles. But there's no epiphany there. I mean, I was sort of, you know, 6 years old, and I'm an actor, you know, I'm a theater person.
Right.
And my father was an experimental artist, and we make art, and we do theater, and we make crazy movies, and we write poems, and we write stuff, and it's just what we do.
So in that way, it's much like your father. You're never a well-heeled artist in that regard.
Unfortunately not. No, yeah.
But you survive it. I mean, you're allowed in the sense of it gives you you have enough success that you can keep doing what you want to do.
Yeah, or it's, you know, sometimes you just get lost for a while. Like I went to L.A. and I had some idea of, you know, working in film or theater there. And they don't really have anything like I had any experience of here in New York. They didn't have any of that out there. You know, it was a very different world. I wound up getting married. I wound up having children. I was still doing theater. I studied film for a while. I learned photography. I was doing this and that, doing some writing some film scripts, trying to sell them. I loved writing film scripts. I was really crappy at selling them. But whatever that chip was, I didn't have it. And so, you know, just doing, you know, exploring. We're all on our process, you know. That's just being alive and living the lives that we're living. You know, we're all in that process, and being in the art process is not that dissimilar at all from actually being in a life process, right? We're all figuring it out, and there's not really any difference between those two things. It's just a matter of then. How are we expressing the unique self, right? And we do that in all different ways, from being writers or poets or painters or bakers or moms and dads or therapists or, you know, whatever it is we do, just like, you know, the way an old guy wears a beret and rides his bike. And that's all art, whether we call it art or we call it the art of living or we just call it living, you know? So when does that moment come where I'm making that career and this is what I'm going to do? You know, we're just kind of born becoming ourselves or figuring that out. And what we're going to do with it, you know, some of us know, some of us search. I probably didn't really figure out what I'm doing now till I was like 50 years old, even though I've been doing it, most of it, all my life.
And does that come because you suddenly have an appreciation for what you've done?
Interesting. I don't know. I think there's a lot of different points in that. In understanding who we are and what our authentic selves are and what the hell is it that we're supposed to be doing? And usually when there's supposed to be, it's a mistake. But what is that thing, you know, that we really feel is calls to us, speaks to us?
So in that search, for many of us, we don't know, and many of us, we seek help. We'll seek therapy to find out mm-hmm. who we are and what we are. Mm-hmm. Did you have therapy in your life?
I had so much when I was a kid, you know, because I started out really kind of weird, like automatically, like at birth. I'm kind of, you know, abandoned and flung here and there, and it's all a very strange story, those really early years. So by the time I'm six, you know, I'm seeing a shrink regular, and I'm getting out of school twice a week early to go to a child psychologist, a play therapy or something like that.
But that's different than seeking it as and then when in you're adulthood.
And then when you're, you know, in jail or you're in an institution or you're in a place, you're getting there, you know, you're seeing a social
right.
worker, you're seeing a shrink or whatever. So by the time I got done with that, I was really done. I was so done with that. But, again, it's just a process. It's just an unfolding. You just do what comes next, and that leads to what comes next. And, you know, there's a point where I sort of shut down after all those crazy young years, and I kind of shut down. I'm really kind of happy just to be a mom and a Hollywood wife.
And that's
and
okay.
And that's fine.
And I apologize for the bluntness of this question,
sure.
but the maybe I'm not completely apologized, but how much does it's got to f*** you up, doesn't it?
But it's all kind of like, so now what you gonna do with it?
Yeah,
you know, so we get to be adults. And we're really missing a lot of stuff. And I think that's pretty true for most people, for more people than it isn't. So then the question is, you know, well, how do you get what you need? You know, how do you figure out whatever it was you didn't get that you needed? How do you figure out how to get that? You know, so that's where we are. And eventually I came around about in different ways to art, to making art, to writing, and that was the process as well.
Two sons.
Yes.
The youngest, an artist.
Yes.
The oldest, a very successful musician. How would they, I don't know if this is a loaded question, but how would they describe you as a mom?
Oh, I don't know.
Because I think you'd be fun.
You know, I think I was too. And it's kind of funny because people are like, wow, she must have been wild. And actually, I was probably a bit on the authoritarian side in my own ways. In other words, you know, I think I definitely had some philosophies of parenting. And one is that children should be safe. Always, and they should be fed, and they should be housed, and they should be in safe environments, and they should be nurtured, and they should have access to resources to explore and practice being and doing whatever it was that they were drawn to and were wanting to be, and then kind of staying out of their way, you know, getting out of the way of whatever that becoming was. But I was kind of strict on some things. It was, you can read or watch whatever you want. Your things belong to you. Your room is your room. Your friends are your friends, and I won't humiliate you or embarrass you publicly or make you do tricks like a toy, like a show dog or any of that. You know, none of that is going to happen to you. You're really safe, and I really respect you. But you don't get to mess up other people's stuff, you know? If adults are talking, you don't interrupt. If you want to contribute, you can. But, you know, we don't, your rooms are your rooms, but don't mess up here. You know, it's not just a free reign. You have to respect the property and person of everyone else, and you likewise will be respected.
So that, of course, is something that I assume you come to as a result of having, in most cases in your life, the opposite of that.
Yeah, and yet having a lot of that too, because I have a story, you get what you get, you know. I got wonderful things from my parents. I mean, we sort of glossed over this really fast biography of all that. But my mother was enchanting. She sang in 7 languages. She was a poet, and she wrote wonderful, funny, dirty poems. And we would sit in bed and eat cookies and read each other our favorite Diane de Prima poems. And we would sing Elizabethan rounds and madrigals and perform them together. And she took me to my first opera on the Bowery when I was 6, because she didn't want to take me to the Metropolitan Opera because I would be too impressed by the costumes and the sets, and she wanted me to appreciate the music. And so, and she was an amphetamine and heroin addict. You know, she came from a tragic background herself. So, and the same with my dad, you know. Yeah, my dad put me in jail, but he got me out. He introduced me to Andy Warhol. I was in his happenings, and I met wonderful people, and I got to be in a culturally just absolutely inspirational, amazing, and magic time, right dead center in that New York City downtown experimental art underground. Just extraordinary time to be there. You know, 62, 63, 64, 65, 66. That was really astonishing. So I'm very grateful to both of them enormously. So,
the last time you saw Andy Warhol was when?
It was, took me out for Italian dinner in Greenwich Village with a bunch of people, and it was, Candy or Brandy Alexander. Somebody had had a sex change operation, and they were very new, and Andy was diagramming it on a napkin with a pen and showing us how the operation went to turn a penis into a vagina. And we were enthralled, and I was, at the time, I was homeless and on the street, and he had Gerard hook me up with a lovely woman named Suzanne, who took me in and gave me a place to live for a little while, and that was the last time I saw Andy.
How old were you, roughly?
15.
Oh, so, okay, so that was not... Later throughout the years, and you didn't return to that.
Mm-mm.
No.
My father knew him on for some years, I think, but I was in Los Angeles and St. Thomas and.
How did his death impact you?
Oh. It was, you know. It's very sad. It's hard to... He meant an awful lot to me. I mean, we haven't really discussed here in terms of, you know, personal... my personal relationship with Andy and the many gifts that he gave me in terms of the art process and the art practice and the work ethic and his incredibly generous... spirit. You know, we always hear how calculating and tight he was, but he was very generous in his own way, and he really did give people that thing that they needed so very often, and was very generous with young people, like Stephen Shore was, I think, 16 years old, and David Dalton and his sister were in their teens. His sister, Sarah Dalton, he gave her the assignment to edit Sleep. You know, 15-year-old girl. I mean, he has this incredible generosity, and he's so open. I mean, he's not ageist. So this totally belies this whole idea of Andy as this sort of cynical, manipulative, exploitive person, which, you know, indeed he may have become, or other people's experience of him was that. But that is not my experience, and not my experience from that time. He was incredibly kind, and he also had this amazing, marvelous, curious, fascinated, endlessly fascinated and endlessly curious spirit, where everything was like, oh, what? Oh, you know, oh, tell us about that. Or, oh, that isn't that interesting? And, you know, he's just intrigued by people and by things, and not locked into, it just has to be this, or I'm not having anything to do with it. He was just incredibly open in that way. And it informs his art, I think, the way he takes his person and his interests and his curiosities and his fascinations and attractions, and finds the way to use those in his art and make art out of it that's so him and is so unique and yet is so very human and shared by us all, you know, and so accessible to so many people, that he's still relevant and he's still fascinating people. Drawing us in.
But given that, given the warmth that you had and the experience that you had, I guess I'm confused as to as you get older, of not wanting to return to that in some way, or to seek his counsel again, or to, as you were on this journey of life and art, of reconnecting in some way with him.
It just didn't happen. I have no doubt that if time had gone on, it would have, you know, that it would all eventually come to a full circle. I'm quite sure it would, but it just didn't. Hmm. It just in terms of timing and where we were. I remember he came once to Los Angeles, but it was kind of, he was doing a big event and there was a mob scene. And it was like, well, do you want to go and try and say hi? And it's like, nah. There'll be another time, or there'll be a better time, or something like that. You just, I connect even more to now, especially that I'm working as a visual artist in an ongoing way myself. I find myself connecting more and feeling more connected to Andy and my dad too, because my dad was a very was an artist, very much in a similar vein, different but similar in terms of their passion and their devotion and their energy, their incredible energy for what they did. So I'm finding that as an older woman, and as my practice in my visual art expands and grows, that I find myself connecting more to those two major influences in my life.
You've been listening to our conversation with Bibi Hansen, pop culture icon, performance artist, musician, and actress known for her work with Andy Warhol. She was part of the University at Albany's Creative Life Conversation series. This conversation was recorded on September 5th, 2018. You can hear the entire chat by going to wamc.org/roundtable, where you can also find out information about this semester's Creative Life events, featuring author Susan Orlean on March 1st and comedian and actor Paul Reiser on April 4th. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.